on FM, online, and on TuneIn 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 17 of our Planet Earth series. Now, these programs are a mix of factual reports and sometimes some music and, other bits and pieces. A satellite is under construction that will be launched into orbit in the Northern Hemisphere autumn of 2023. Called PACE, P-A-C-E, it will study phytoplankton in the world's oceans. Now, phytoplankton are microscopic algae that form the base of the aquatic food chain. Now, how, you may ask, can a satellite hundreds of kilometres out in space measure microscopic algae in the ocean? The satellite will carry the Ocean Colour Instrument. This is a hyperspectral scanning radiometer that will measure light reflected off the ocean, that's sunlight. The term hyperspectral means finely detailed measurements of colour. Now, this instrument will measure light from the near ultraviolet through the visible and into the near infrared. The plankton can be identified because they reflect particular colours. Indeed, different species of plankton reflect different colours. This will allow the satellite to map not only where the plankton is, but also tell what type it is. The PACE satellite will be able to identify both beneficial and harmful phytoplankton communities. Now, PACE is an acronym for Plankton, Aerosol, Cloud, Ocean, Ecosystem. In February this year, it passed its critical design review and a system-level engineering test unit completed thermal vacuum tests in March. Another instrument to be flown aboard PACE is being tested in space. A satellite called HARP, H-A-R-P, was launched last November. This hyperangular rainbow polarimeter continues to perform well, so the follow-on, HARP-2, is now being assembled. A third instrument for the PACE satellite is called SPECS-1. This spectropolarimeter for planetary exploration is being built by the Netherlands Institute for Space Research and by Airbus Defence and Space Netherlands. Now, SPECS-1 has been undergoing environmental testing and will be delivered to the PACE team early next year. Otto Haskamp is the principal investigator for SPECS-1, and he works at the Netherlands Institute for Space Research.
SPECS-1 will measure the intensity and degree of polarization of light that is reflected by small particles in the atmosphere. These particles are called aerosols. So overall, aerosols counterbalance the warming by greenhouse gases, but we don't know by what amount. And because this is so unknown, it's hard to predict future climate change. And with SPECS-1, we want to accurately measure the effect of aerosols on clouds and climate.
Jeroen Rijtjens is the instrument scientist for SPECS-1. Again, he works at the Netherlands Institute for Space Research.
One challenge in building and designing SPECS-1 was the design of the optical system. Since SPECS-1 is a multi-viewing instrument, we needed to be able to capture the light from five different directions into a single compact instrument.
We look forward to that satellite telling us more about our planet Earth.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless.
During the recent bushfires in the western United States, an instrument on the International Space Station was providing firefighters with high-resolution images of the fire's progression. The EcoStress instrument measures the surface temperature below the path of the space station. The station passes over the northwestern states, such as Oregon, twice a day. The images have a resolution of around about 70 meters. They show where the fire fronts are and where the critical infrastructure is threatened. Comparing images in a time sequence shows the movement of the fires. Well, I think it's time for a little bit of music. Yes, of course, it's going to be about Earth. And this is called De-Erd, and it's by a singer called Judith Heyman, one of our favourites here on The Space Show. And in this case, an interstellar traveller sings nostalgically about the distant Earth. Sky is a global monitoring provider based in Seattle, Late this month, Rocket Lab will launch two of its satellites from the Mahia Peninsula using an Electron rocket. Two other similar launches will follow during September. Last May, an Electron failed to orbit two Black Sky satellites of the same type. The August launch will orbit Black Sky's eighth and ninth satellites in their planned constellation. The craft are high-resolution, multi-spectral satellites in low Earth orbit. They offer real-time geospatial intelligence and monitoring services. Black Sky combines high-resolution images of the Earth captured by its small satellites with its proprietary artificial intelligence software to deliver analytics and insights to industries. These industries include transportation, infrastructure, land use, defense, supply chain management, and humanitarian aid. Now, Black Sky is not to be confused with the Black Sky Aerospace Company, which is based in Queensland, quite a separate company. Well, we have spoken previously on the ICESat mission, and it's a satellite in orbit around the Earth that measures land elevation.
Using the most advanced Earth-observing laser instrument NASA has ever flown in space, scientists have made precise, detailed measurements of how the elevation of ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica have changed over 16 years.
We can actually see some processes at a scale that's almost long enough to tell us about the climate in those two places.
Scientists took ice sheet elevation measurements from 2003, overlaid data from 2019, and analyzed where the data sets intersected in order to see where ice was lost or gained. For example, the study definitively shows that the East Antarctic ice sheet, the largest of all the ice sheets, is growing.
But more importantly, what we find is that growing is more than offset by increased losses coming from the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is thinning very rapidly as it responds to warmer ocean temperatures, specifically in the Amundsen Sea embayment area.
The West Antarctic side, we're seeing strong thinning on the ice shelves, which is causing drawdown on the inland ice, on the grounded ice upstream. Most of that is being caused because of changes in ocean heat flux underneath the ice shelves, which is causing them to thin. And then consequently, the buttressing force is being lost against the grounded ice, and the grounded ice is then flowing faster into the ocean and causing sea level rise. In Greenland, we're seeing different signatures. Again, in the center of the ice sheet in the plateau, we're seeing increased accumulation. So there is a slight increase in mass in the center. But the overall signal for Greenland is one of thinning. And that is being caused by ocean and atmospheric signals acting all around the edges of Greenland.
So we're seeing 200 gigatons per year of ice flowing into the oceans, which is enough to raise sea level by about 2/3 of a millimeter per year.
Combine that with the almost 118 gigatons lost in Antarctica, and sea level has risen a total of 14 millimeters over the 16-year period due to ice sheet melt. It may seem small, but the small changes add up.
What we expect by the end of the century is, you know, on the order of 2, 3, maybe 4 feet of sea level rise. And because we have all of our infrastructure that is built around the coasts, we have a lot of vulnerability to a meter change in sea level rise.
The potential impact from sea level rise is one critical motivation for the continued study of the mechanics driving the changes in the ice sheets.
If we can understand those mechanisms and how they've played out over the last 30 years, well, then we can start to look and think about how will those ice sheets respond to what we project the climate to be into the future.
Now, new data from the old ICESat and the new ICESat 2 satellites is being compared to measure changes in the ice layers of the world. And that feature came courtesy of the Goddard Space Flight Center.
88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Planet Earth is blue.
Let's Last week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change presented the first part of its 2021 report. Rowan Dean sometimes rants on Sky News about global change, or rather what he sees as the lack of it. Ahead of the release of the IPCC report, Rowan predicted that it would have climate hysteria focused on the scary monster called Australia and the evils of the mining coal. Here is a part of what he said.
It's all on again for the climate cult tomorrow when the IPCC, this is the UN climate change body, releases its latest landmark report on catastrophic global warming or heating or whatever they're calling it now. Get ready for a veritable deluge of terrifying, apocalyptic, doomsday-laden headlines. Already The Guardian has got in early in the scare-the-kiddies witless stakes with a newer, bigger, even deadlier gas than carbon dioxide, something that has a warming potential more than 80 times worse than carbon dioxide. It's called methane. Yes, this new scarier gas is produced from shale gas wells, poorly managed conventional oil and gas extraction, and methane comes from the farming of animals. That's right, the latest villain in the climate cult's never-ending scare campaign are cows and sheep. Data from StatsNZ, just released for the years 2007 to 2019, shows dairy emissions from the climate socialist paradise of St. Jacinda Ardern rose by 3.18% in 2019 to a total of 17,719 kilotons of carbon dioxide equivalent. But you watch. When the IPCC report is published this week, all the climate hysteria will be focused not on the hypocritical Ardern, but it will all be about the terrible climate change scary monster called Australia and the evils of mining coal. That's how this particular scary movie always ends.
Well, Rowan Dean may well have just discovered methane, but on June the 9th and June the 16th, we here on The Space Show reported on MethaneSat and New Zealand's involvement in it. One of the reasons New Zealand is using MethaneSat is to monitor that country's agricultural methane emissions. Now, methane is responsible for 20% of global warming since the Industrial Revolution. In 2018, the food system contributed to one-third of all human-caused greenhouse gas emissions. Now, methane is around 30 times more potent than carbon dioxide over the space of a century. Now, this feature from the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland.
Methane shows up nearly everywhere on our planet. It can come from a variety of sources, like wetlands, fossil fuels, and even livestock. These diverse sources add to the challenge of tracking this potent greenhouse gas. A molecule of methane is able to trap more heat than a CO2 molecule. In fact, it is the second leading gas that is contributing to climate change. And since the Industrial Revolution, global methane concentrations have doubled.
It's contributed roughly 20 to 30% of the climate change that we've experienced to date. And so there's an urgency in understanding where the sources are coming from so that we can be better prepared to mitigate methane emissions where there are opportunities to do so.
By using a combination of field observations, airborne surveys, and data from international partners, NASA has been able to create a new model of the sources and global transport of methane. This model allows scientists to track the global methane budget and better understand the changes over time.
Everything around methane tends to be a few years behind carbon dioxide, so we're just catching up to how important and how dynamic methane is as a greenhouse gas. We see these pulses of methane in different places, and when we look deeper, we understand that those pulses are occurring for different reasons. So we might see wetlands in one region, we might see industrial pollution in another area.
With this new model, we can track the pulses of methane across the globe to better pinpoint the conditions and activities that may cause them.
Methane is a difficult gas for us to understand, given the diversity of sources, and then how the sources and the emissions get transported throughout the atmosphere. The 3D simulation that we produced here helps us better put together the entire story for the sources of methane and as well as its removal from the atmosphere.
By taking a look at the story of methane, scientists and policymakers can better understand the sources of methane emissions and work to reduce this greenhouse gas.
For more about methane, listen to our Space Show specials from New Zealand, broadcast on June the 9th and June 16. You can find them at space.southernfm.com.au. That's space.southernfm.com.au. Then scroll down to near the bottom of the page where you'll find a list of 2021 programs. Click on that link and then scroll down to June 9 and June 16. And while you're at the the space.southernfm.com.au website, you might like to look into some of our other features that we have there. We've got over 1,800 of them up on the web at the moment. Now, let's go off to Mars and hear about methane as well.
Thanks, Mary. It's been a pretty exciting last few days, I must say. In 5 minutes, I'm going to give you the history of methane on Mars, which started off a few years ago, actually, with Earth-based sensing when plumes were reported from Mauna Kea infrared spectroscopy. And so when we proposed the SAM experiment on the Curiosity rover, the mass spectrometer down in that region has noise, background contamination. And so we invited Chris Webster to put a tunable laser spectrometer on SAM. Tunable laser spectrometer is a nice small device where light bounces back between two mirrors. And for a very small device, you get like many meters of path length and great sensitivity. So we got to the surface of Mars. The ground-based observations had been controversial, to say the least. And so we were going to go to Mars and understand whether it was really there or not. It turned out it was still controversial. But remember the date, June 15, 2013. It was after we'd landed, after we'd made a few measurements, and they were kind of close to zero, within the noise of being zero. On June 15, 2013, we saw a higher value, 6 parts per billion. That was interesting. It rapidly went away. That was Mars year 31. You start Mars year counting from 1955, I guess. Mars year 32, in the northern spring, something really interesting. We saw a period of about 4 months where methane came up, kind of between 6 and 9 ish parts per billion. We made 4 measurements over 2 months, and then it went away again. Mars year 33 in northern autumn. Going into winter, again, we saw another value, 6 parts per billion, which went away. And then really nothing in direct measurements in Mars year 34. But in the meantime, what we had developed was basically using a device we had developed to enrich noble gases on Mars to pull out xenon and such. We use that basically, Charles Molespin, who's here, spent days in the lab developing it, basically sucking the atmosphere through these enrichment cells, scrubbing out the carbon dioxide, and basically enriching the methane in the tunable laser spectrometer by a factor of about 25. And we did that over multiple Mars years. We have about 10 points, Mars years 31, 32, 33, and 34. And those measurements were all below 1 part per billion, between 0.2 and 0.6, and they kind of showed a seasonal variation. But we had never seen enhanced methane, or methane plume, or spike, or whatever you want to call it, with the enrichment experiment until last week. So this run was run Wednesday in the middle of the night, and then on Thursday we got the data back, and Chris Webster's words were incredible and dumbfounded, and we were surprised. We saw 21 parts per billion, the highest we'd ever seen in the enrichment mode, which was really interesting. So that's a story which rapidly somehow made its way to the New York Times, and we decided anyway, with great help from Ashwin, we would scrap the weekend plan and make that run again. And we did make the run again. The data just came back, and in fact, the methane plume went away. We measured it both with direct and with enrichment. It's back down now to below one part per billion, so kind of consistent with what we've seen all along. But just a couple things to note. I asked you to remember that date, June 15, because the day after that, Mars Express planetary Fourier spectrometer had flown over Gale Crater, and they were using it in a mode where basically they stared at Gale Crater, quite complicated, but basically summing up hundreds of spectra, and they found what amounted to, in their paper, 46 tons of methane in an area that was kind of 250 kilometers by 250 kilometers, including Gale Crater. And so that was really fascinating. And other measurements before and after that, where we had seen zero methane, they didn't see any as well. So that was pretty interesting. And they published that on April 1. You should never publish a methane paper on April 1, I guess. So that's the story. A plume came and a plume went. We're very confident of the measurement. And I should say that both Mars Express and Trace Gas Orbiter, which to date has not seen methane, although it only senses down to a few kilometers above the surface, we're coordinating with them, and we're very happy to make coordinated measurements and so on. So that's the long and the short story of the history of methane on Mars.
Yeah, we're going to, we've been looking at the atmosphere, in that case of Mars, but we're also looking at the atmosphere of the Earth. So why don't we have the Atmosphere Song by Tom Glaser and Dottie Evans, and this comes from the 1950s.
Where is the stratosphere?
Just above the troposphere.
Where is the tropopause?
It is in between.
Where is the stratosphere?
Under the ionosphere.
Where is the exosphere?
Highest on the scene. All together, they make up the atmosphere. All together, that's the atmosphere. Troposphere and stratosphere, ionosphere and exosphere. All together, that's the atmosphere.
Where is the weather made? Where is all the weather made?
Where is the weather made?
In the troposphere.
Stratosphere.
Just above the troposphere.
Where is the tropopause?
It is in between.
Where is the stratosphere?
Under the ionosphere.
Where is the exosphere?
Highest on the scene.
All together, they make up the atmosphere. All together, that's the atmosphere. Troposphere and stratosphere, ionosphere and exosphere. All together, that's the atmosphere.
Where is the weather made? Where is all the weather made?
Where is the weather made?
In the troposphere.
For over two decades, the Space Show has been telling you the sad story of the felling of the Amazon forest. Now we're able to bring you a good news story. The world is literally a greener place than it was 20 years ago. Data from two NASA satellites has revealed the source for much of this new foliage: India and China. Taken altogether, the greening of the planet represents an increase in leaf area on plants and trees equivalent to the area covered by all the Amazon rainforests. Compared to the early 2000s, there has been a 5% increase. China and India account for one-third of the greening. This despite these two containing only 9% of the planet's land area covered in vegetation. The effect stems mainly from ambitious tree planting in China and intensive agriculture in both countries. China has a national plan to conserve and expand forests. This plan was developed in an effort to reduce the effects of soil erosion, air pollution, and climate change. The land area used to grow crops in both China and India is comparable to almost 2 million square kilometres. This has not changed much since the early 2000s. Both countries have increased both their annual total green leaf area and their food production. Now, this has been achieved through multiple cropping practices where a field is replanted to produce another harvest several times a year. Production of food has increased by over 35% since the year 2000.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at Planet Earth. Bop, 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 bop. This is Planet Earth.